I didn't have any classes with Fletch and rarely saw him in the halls, but I had two classes with Drew DeLuca, and he had lunch the same period as Fletch, so I had him pass along that I wouldn't need a ride. When sixth period let out, I made my way over to the parking lot where Lena was waiting for me next to her blue 97 Beetle. We got in and blasted the heat. Unlike Fletch's ancient Civic, Alina's Beetle actually warmed up pretty quick. Everything but the silence was comfortable. Do you want to get right into it? Alina looked at me out of the corner of her eyes. They were so blue. She shook her head. Not while I'm driving. We rode in silence until we pulled up in front of an old, good-sized colonial house.
Is this okay?
Yeah, sure.
I don't want to talk about it in public.
That's totally fine. Alina looked relieved as she hit the garage door opener. It was like she thought bringing me over to her house was really putting me out. Getting out of the car, I noticed the garage was otherwise empty. We were alone. Abby, an aging golden retriever that the Amenevs apparently didn't kennel, greeted us with her tail wagging and her leash in her mouth.
I have to take her out. Make yourself at home.
Just being inside Elena's house felt so intimidating. Identity is everything to a teenager, and to bring someone else into your home was to expose a part of you that was beyond your control. It was laying bare the environment that had produced you. When I first entered Fletch's house, his discomfort was evident. His house was just a place that he passed through to get to his room. For Scary Carrie, her house was a source of shame. Mrs. Peterson's small, ill-kept home was a constant reminder to Carrie, not just of her parents' failed marriage, but of her mother's lack of education. They were both stuck there, in a house that smelled like deli meats and the water that feta cheese is packed in. Smell that started in Mrs. Peterson's work clothes, but now infused into everything they owned. I entered Alina's house with the same reverence I would a church. It had a feeling to it that put you in the mood to sip hot chocolate and watch snow fall. There were candles and tea lights on the tables, and holiday-themed knickknacks on the walls. The piney scent of Christmas trees filled the air, and as I collapsed onto the overstuffed couch, it occurred to me that for the first time all day, I felt relaxed. After she returned, Alina led me downstairs into the game room, a finished basement dominated by a full-sized pool table. She offered me a soda from the mini-fridge behind the wet bar, and then we sat down in a love seat in front of the big-screen TV. Alina stared at me while I spoke. I stared back. It was impossible to look anywhere else. I recounted the story Fletcher told me, as faithfully as I could. All the while, I was very conscious of where her legs were in relation to mine. They tugged at me as if they had gravity. She seemed fine the whole time that I talked, but the moment I was done, she began to gasp for air, like she'd been holding her breath. Then the sobbing started. I was quick to close the gap between us. I held her for several minutes while her slender frame shook and quivered. When she regained her composure, she slowly withdrew to her end of the love seat.
God, I'm so sorry, she said, wiping her eyes with her sleeves.
Don't be.
I'm such a mess. I feel ashamed when I'm happy. I'm like a victim when I'm ashamed. It takes everything I've got to keep it together. It's exhausting.
Have you talked to anyone? Seen a... you know.
Yeah. But she won't give me anything.
Well, that's not a bad thing.
So you don't believe any of it?
Her right leg began bouncing up and down on the ball of her foot.
I thought you were Mr. Ghost Hunter.
I scoffed. The corner of her mouth twitched as if she were about to smile, and for a fleeting second I felt connected to her. To the old Alina. I didn't run around telling everyone that I met why I cared so much about ghost stories. I didn't wear anything that personal on my sleeve, but I told Alina. She listened and nodded, and understood me. Can I ask you something? She nodded. Why does it matter to you if the widower's clock is real?
I need them to be wrong about me. The people who stare at me in the halls blame me like Fletch and John Murphy.
Fletch is just hurting. He doesn't blame you. Not really.
Yeah, he does! Everyone does! All they get are these little snippets about how much Rob loved me, and I've heard them talk about it. They say that I thought that I was better than him because I live in a big house, or because he wasn't a jock, or because he was nerdy. He loved me, and I was a bitch for rejecting him.
Elena pulled her legs up to her chest and hugged her knees. I remember being struck by how much she looked like a little girl. It seemed strange at the time, but in hindsight, at scarcely 17, Elena practically was a little girl. A kid realizing for the first time that her classmates felt entitled to opinions about what she did with her body and affections. I wanted to tell her that that wasn't true. That no one really believed she was a snob about money or a shallow bitch. I wanted to, but I also heard the whispers. "Truth is," she said, "the only thing I really knew about him is that he made me uncomfortable." I moved beside her and I put my arm around her shoulder. I could feel how tense she was as she stared straight ahead. "It's not your fault." Her hair smelled like vanilla. "Elena, look at me." She looked so full of uncertainty. Scared. I put my other hand on her wrist. "I'm gonna go down there. To Quabbin." She grabbed me by the shoulder and held me like I might fall. "It's okay." I couldn't help smiling at her concern. "I won't go in. I'm just gonna listen to the bells." She studied my face. We were only inches apart. My heart was racing. "Besides," I said as I leaned in, "I want to." And I kissed her. Her lips were slow to respond. Doubts raced through me. Was she surprised? Was this a rejection? Had I crossed a line? I felt like Scary Carrie must have back in Greenfield. But Elena didn't withdraw. Maybe it had nothing to do with me. Maybe it was just a survivor's guilt. And after a long couple of seconds, Elena kissed me back. My brain went fuzzy. I almost had to stop. It's tough to kiss with a grin. I was kissing Elena Eminef. I slipped my fingers through her wild hair. Elena, who ran track. I could feel my legs pressing against her. Elena, who smelled like vanilla and smirked when she used to smile. I tried to press my leg between hers, but she kept her legs closed, and that was fine. I was happy just to be kissing her. We spent the next few minutes on the love seat. It wasn't the sort of first kiss that you would imagine. I was nervous, and she was still. At the time, I remember thinking that it was more intimate than passionate, but that made sense to me. She wasn't in a real good place. Being with her was going to be like building a house of cards. Take a slow hand, and the slightest misstep could bring her crumbling down. She wanted to drive me home before her parents returned from work. As we were getting our coats on, I said, "Hey, let's see a movie." She didn't answer immediately. I thought for a second that she hadn't heard me. "I can't." I kissed her and asked again, but it didn't help. "What if someone sees us?" I wanted people to see us. I didn't care what people thought about her. I didn't even give a rat's ass what Fletch thought about her. "Please don't tell him. Don't tell anybody. I can't handle how they'll look at me." She broke down. I held her. As I lay in bed that night, I found myself fantasizing about Elena. It wasn't sexual. Hell, it wasn't even about the kiss. It was about the most mundane things. Spooning her while we watch TV. Holding her hand while we walk down the hallways at school. Having little arguments over who'd sit at whose lunch table. And that's when I resolved that I had to find the spire in the woods. Right in the middle of the fantasy, Aelina apologizing for not wanting to sit with my friends and telling fantasy me that I was the most important thing in the world to her. I had to find it for Aelina. To get her out from under some guilt that she held on her shoulders. And was it really so crazy to think that maybe there might be some truth to it? Even if I was skeptical of the connection to the widower's clock, couldn't Robert Edward Keenan have followed the sound of the bells? Couldn't he have discovered a spire sticking out of the ground? Maybe he even found a body. Hadn't Fletch mentioned someone had gone missing from that trailer park? If he had found her corpse, it could have certainly pushed him over the edge. The thought sent a shiver up my spine. The last couple of weeks before Christmas vacation were always filled with midterms and projects, and that year was no exception. It was the last thing in the world either of us wanted to do, but with group projects due Monday, I had to meet Scary Carrie at the library. We were bullshitting while I busted my rear looking for resources for our presentation on Roop Spire. I had practically carried Carrie through the whole first half of European history when I told her that I had changed my mind. I wanted to visit Quabbin. Carrie was thrilled. So when do you want to go? I don't know. Sometimes over break, I guess. We try to figure out everything about them. Who? The clockmaker and his wife. Only one of my Haunted New England books told the story of the widower's clock. And maybe it was because I'd intentionally been skeptical that the story was grounded in any sort of reality. But in honesty, it never occurred to me that there was anything more to know. But if there was a clockmaker, he'd had to have made clocks. And if there'd been a murder, there must be an obituary. Carrie disappeared into the basement where the library kept their microfiche. With her gone, I was able to finish researching our paper in short order, and by the time I wandered downstairs, she had found out quite a bit. The clockmaker was a German immigrant named Adolf Reifler, born in 1857. He was hired somewhere between 1905 and 1907 to construct a clock for the Custom House Tower in Boston by an architect named Robert Swain Peabody. The clock was a failure. In an effort to show up his two brothers, who were also master clockmakers, Reifler attempted to miniaturize several of the motor's components. While the clock ran, it failed to keep accurate time. The clock was referred to by many as Adolf's folly until the mid-1930s, when Hitler's infamy outstripped Reifler's. The bride was Robert Swain Peabody's niece, Amy Lowell Putnam, born 1897. She was just 16 when she married Reifler, who was by that time, 51 years old. I suppose the age difference wasn't that unusual in those times, but back in 1999, when Aelin was 17, the idea of her with a man in his 50s made my skin crawl. It also made me regret Amy Lowell Putnam with more sympathy. Imagine being married off at 16 to a man more than three times your age. Imagine 20 years of marriage to that man, waking up to find yourself in your mid-30s, still in the heat of your sexual prime with a husband in his 70s. I mean, of course she was attracted to other men. We couldn't find an obituary for Amy Lowell Putnam, nor for Amy Putnam Reifler. Scary Carrie took it as a sign that the Putnams, Lowells, or Peabodys, all powerful families, had covered up the scandalous manner in which Amy Lowell had died. I, on the other hand, chalked it up to the microfiche. Being a bitch to work with. What we did find of interest, though, was a picture of Einfeld in 1938. It depicted a large hill with most of its trees cut down, a tractor pushing aside some debris, and a lone man standing with his back to a large colonial building. The large colonial was the only one still standing, and it had a little tower. We couldn't tell whether or not it had a clock. The old microfiche view screens didn't exactly have great resolution, but based on its proximity to the hill, it was easy to see how the loose soil could have enveloped it, or another building much like it, when the floodwaters came pouring through, leaving just a spire peeking out above the earth. We only found one more reference to Adolf Reifler, an obituary published in the Boston Globe in 1941. I wish I could remember the date. It mentioned that he was wanted for questioning in regard to a disappearance, but that was all. Reifler had died in Munich. The cause of death was omitted, but at 84 it was probably just old age. Reifler must have fled the country sometime in the mid-1930s, at a time when the Germany he returned to must have been very different from the Germany he had originally left. I don't know why, but somehow knowing these historical details made the story of the widower's clock so much more plausible. It was no longer a story of a man with an awful, unfaithful wife. The characters defined by nothing more than their relationship to one another. It started to become a story of two people. Amy Lowell Putnam, restless and starved for marital attention, shackled to an old man incapable of giving her what she needed, and proud Adolf Reifler, obsessed with proving himself after his failure, designing the clock for Customs House Tower, too busy and too old to see what his young wife was up to. Since her mom had the car that day, when we got hungry, Carrie and I had to choose between waiting for my mom to pick us up or hoofing it down to the House of Pizza to grab a bite. Despite the cold, we opted for the latter. Settling into a booth, a hot slice in front of both of us, things between Carrie and I felt right again for the first time since our trip to Greenfield. We quickly fell into discussing the plans for our trip. "We should head out early," she said. "The first time Rob heard the bells, it was just after sundown." "Yeah, but the later it is, the less likely we are to bump into some park rangers." "Think there are gates or fences?" "The roads in or out might be gated, but fences, nah. Quabbin's too big." Just as the words left my mouth, Fletch plopped down right next to me, his friend Murph lingering behind him. "Hey, I didn't see you guys come in," he said. "How long you been here?" I don't know what I felt exactly. Embarrassment? Shame? But even though there was nothing in Fletch's face to indicate that he'd heard me, I felt that feeling you get when your parents tell you, "We're not mad, we're just disappointed." I'd been so wrapped up in the fun of going on a ghost hunt and clicking with Scary Carrie again that I'd lost sight of the fact that Rob Keenan had killed himself. I'd forgotten the only reason I knew about the spire in the woods was because, well, because of his suicide note, and had actually been happy about the whole thing, while two guys who had lost a good friend, quite possibly because of the spire, were sitting right behind me. I don't know, a bit," I mumbled. "Oh, you want to ride home? I could take both of you." I really didn't. "Sure," Carrie said. Murph had just found out that he'd been accepted via early admission to UMass Amherst, a topic Scary Carrie found intriguing. Like many unhappy high school students, Carrie hung a lot of her hopes on the idea that her life would get better in college. She knew she didn't have the grades to get into a top-tier school. Hell, she knew that UMass Amherst was a real reach, but she still had hope into getting to UMass Lowell and transfer after a year or two. Of course, Murphy hadn't thought he'd be accepted either.
"Definitely apply early," he said. "Show them you're serious and see if you can get a reference from someone who went there and they list where all the teachers went to in that yearbook each year. Like half of them went to UMass."
Carrie was hanging off Murph's every word, but I wasn't paying much attention to what he was saying. I was too busy hoping against hope that after we dropped Carrie off, Fletch would announce that he wanted to hang out with Murph some more and, as such, would have to drop me off next. That didn't happen. And soon, we were alone in the car together. The second the door closed behind Murph, Fletch dropped his mask. And I knew that he'd heard me.
"After what I told you, you're going to the Quabbin?"
"Yeah."
"Are you fucking retarded?"
Fletch was a pretty big guy. Coupled with the hurt and anger in his voice, intimidated me into silence. We drove on, listening to nothing but the heater, struggling in vain to dispel the cold. After a few miles, I found myself resenting Fletch. Who was he to speak to me like that? And why the fuck should I feel guilty for his sake? He lost a friend, and he had my sympathy, but that didn't entitle him to treat me like garbage. What'd you tell me for? Fletch didn't answer my question. He just kept driving.
"Huh? Why'd you tell me about it if you didn't want me to look into it?"
Fletch tightened his grip on the steering wheel and ground his teeth together as if he was literally chewing over the question. We were in our neighborhood before he finally answered.
"Who else could I tell? Did you know the school's been contacting the parents of everyone who goes to that special counseling session? They're reporting any early warning signs they see in the sessions. You think I want my parents making me see somebody or sticking me on meds? I can't go in there with the fucking ghost story. Butch's anger had left him. By the time he pulled into my driveway, he looked deflated. I thought you'd believe me. Or could disprove it. Or shit, I don't know. It seemed like Fletch and Alina were looking to me to absolve their sins. Alina wanted me to prove that Rob had found a spire sticking up from the ground in the middle of the woods, and it was the reason that he'd taken his own life. Fletch wanted me to tell him that it was just a ghost story. I honestly couldn't tell you which I believed. But I had to know. I haven't even told Murph, he said. I couldn't handle it if he blamed me for letting Rob go on his own. What would you have done if you'd been with him? I don't know. Fletch wouldn't look me in the eyes. But at least he wouldn't have been alone. Well, you don't have to worry about us. We just want to hear the bells. It's not like we're going to swim out there or anything. Yeah, I know. I'm not going to let you. I had no idea how Fletch intended to stop us. It's not like we needed his permission to visit a public park, and I told him this as much. Fletch looked at me like I was an idiot. If you're going, then so am I, he said. I didn't argue. I mean, if he felt guilty for letting Rob go looking for the spire in the woods alone, maybe being there with Carrie and me would help him get over it. As Fletch backed out of the driveway, I realized there was another reason I didn't protest. Scary Carrie. Yeah, things that day felt normal between us, but I was still gun-shy about spending that much time alone with her. Especially on the shore of a moonlit lake. And as an added bonus, now we didn't have to worry about getting Ecto-1 for the night. Alina kept her distance to school, especially after I attempted to steal a kiss from her the Wednesday before winter break. I had left class to use the bathroom and bumped into her on my way back. There were these moments, a few minutes here and there, where she seemed like nothing was wrong, where her smile and laugh would come easily, and walking her back to class that day was one of those moments. The corridor was nearly deserted. Just before I reached the door to her classroom, I stopped her. I slid one hand around her slender waist, and I slipped the other through her hair towards her neck. I leaned in to kiss her, and she withdrew from me, from my touch, as if I was on fire. And just like that, the old Alina was gone, and the broken one was left in her place. We stood there, apologizing to each other, her reassuring me that I had nothing to apologize for, me doing the same, before she finally backed into her classroom and shut the door. I was thankful Thursday was our last day. Winter break couldn't arrive soon enough. I saw Alina twice over the break, once before Carrie, Fletch, and I went to Quapan, and once after. Alina's parents had a cabin in the foot of the Suwannee Peak in Maine, where they usually spent New Year's Eve, but that year they decided to go up on the 27th and come back down on the 30th, so that Alina wouldn't miss her weekly therapy session. The day after Christmas, she came over to our house for dinner. My parents were wonderful. I had warned them about how nervous and anxious she likely was to be. I didn't say a word about the suicide notes or the spire in the woods, but I had told them that Rob had had a crush on her and that, well, Alina wasn't coping well with his death. They couldn't have been more understanding. Ordinarily, my dad would have delighted in teasing anyone I brought home for the first time, but he refrained. Instead, whenever there was a lull in conversation, he teased my younger brother, who had gotten for Christmas that year, among other things, a Furby, and insisted on bringing it to the dinner table.
Don't let me catch you feeding that thing after midnight.
My brother was too young to catch the reference and looked up confused. It's only 6:30.
Well, it's always after midnight somewhere.
My mother, from her part, also resisted in the natural instincts. Usually whenever someone came over to my house for the first time, she'd practically interrogate them, stopping just shy of shining a flashlight in their face. This habit of hers had been particularly rough on Scary Carrie, whom my mom was briefly convinced was on drugs,
After dinner, my dad suggested that I show Alina the TV that I had gotten for Christmas the day before. The TV that was in my room. God, he really was a great dad. I really like your family, Alina said once the door shut behind us. I scoffed. Believe me, they were on their best behavior. Drew DeLuca was a film advocate of the idea that a romantic movie was not the best movie to watch with the girl that you wanted to get romantic with. For starters, most of them were, in his view, very crappy movies, and the good ones ran the danger of actually holding the girl's interest. What you wanted was a movie that was pleasant and charming, but light enough to make you miss a good chunk of it without feeling lost and needing to rewind. The sort of movie that you stumble across while watching TV on a Sunday afternoon, and finish, even though it was already midway through. I threw in Mavericks. Alina sat on the floor, and I followed suit, but not before grabbing a couple of pillows off my bed. Her movements were stiff as she settled down on the pillow. I tried not to appear too eager as I got down behind her and draped my arm over her waist. As the movie started, I kept thinking about those fantasies I'd had the night after our first kiss, about how pleasant it'd be just to lie next to Alina watching TV. Just being near her and nothing more. I was right. But actually being beside her, my hand resting lightly against her flat stomach, I found other ideas even more enticing. I pulled myself closer to her, savoring the fragrance that her vanilla-scented shampoo left in her wild hair. My fingers crept slowly, almost imperceptibly, up her toned body. Alina stopped me. "Your parents ever come up here?" she whispered. "No, we're alone." "Actually, would you mind if we just watch this? I haven't seen it before." Oh, no, that's cool, I said, mentally cursing the day DeLuca had been born. I spent the next hour knowing the agony of a man without any fresh water, stuck in a life raft adrift at sea. After the movie, my luck didn't improve much. The credits began to roll, and I had it in my head that Alina might feel more comfortable expressing her affection for me if she felt that she was in control. I kissed her neck where it met her jaw and pulled her lithe little body on top of mine. The pressure of her weight pushing down on me was an excruciating pleasure. My eyes rolled back in my head, conscious thought melted away. My fingers found their way to the bare skin of her lower back, and I could feel the slight bumps of where her vertebrae rose above her skin. It was oddly intoxicating. When had I become attracted to spines? I brought my cheek to hers and angled my face so that our mouths aligned. Her lips parted tentatively. I listened for subtle changes in her breathing that would tell me when it'd be safe to make the next move. Her breathing deepened. I slid my hand up, up, up her back, all the way to her Santini bra strap. I'd never touched a bra before in my life, and only had a vague idea how to guide the hooks from my eyes. I nibbled her ear as my fingers fumbled beneath Alina's shirt, and that's when I felt she was crying. Hey, it's okay, look, I whispered while pulling my hand out of her shirt, see? She sniffled and she turned her head away from me. I was so scared. I knew I couldn't be too eager with her. I knew that I couldn't press her too hard. She was in a fragile state, and there I was, thinking with anything but my hand. My only defense was that I wanted to make her feel good. I'd thought since she liked me, she'd like my touch as much as I craved hers. But I thought wrong on so many levels. I gently pushed her chin up to look me in the eyes. I didn't mean to push you too fast. Okay. Are you okay? She nodded, and I held her until she pushed herself up off of me. Alina paced around my room, doing a breathing exercise her therapist had taught her. I went downstairs to grab us a couple glasses of water. It was less than the least I could do. While I was in the kitchen, my dad gave me a questioning look and a thumbs up behind my mother's back. I shook my head no, and I felt like a failure. When she was calm enough to sit down, we sat on the bed, far apart from one another, sipping the water and talking. "It's not you," she said. Yet. I mean, don't worry about it. I know you like me. Alina gave a little nod as she stared down at the water. "Hey, this will pass," I said. "People at school will move on to something else, and leave you alone, and you can get back to normal. Alina got up and started pacing again. My parents don't even think I can skip a session for New Year's. How's that for normal? I hate that we're not going to be up at Shawnee for New Year's. She put the glass down on my desk, her hands as fidgety as her legs. Every year, we go skiing in the morning. Then we drive into North Conway, and we have dinner, and we watch the fireworks until my mom gets too cold and wants to head back. That's all I want. I can't even handle that. What if I find something down at Quabbin? Alina stopped, practically mid-step, and stared at me. I hadn't noticed until just then, but she had bags under her eyes. Would that help? When are you going? Tomorrow. Alina stared at me. The energy in the room had changed. I could practically smell her desperation as easily as her vanilla-scented shampoo. She needed me to find the spire in the woods and to prove that it was the widower's clock. Prove that Rob hadn't killed himself because she broke his heart, but because he'd been haunted by the ghost of Amy Lowell Putnam. And if Alina Amenev needed that, so did I. To hell with Fletch. To hell with just hearing the bells. I was going to find the spire. What's with the bag? Fletch asks as I tossed my duffel bag onto the back seat and got inside his car. If memory serves, it'd been 25 or so that day and felt even colder in that little Civic. Supplies, incense, Mom's Bible, a couple flashlights, some miscellaneous crap I borrowed from Carrie. Fletch acknowledged that he'd heard me with a soft grunt, and we were on our way to pick up Scary Carrie. Truth be told, while the bag did have my mother's Bible and the flashlights, the miscellaneous crap I borrowed from Carrie was actually a bicycle pump and a pool raft shaped like a small boat that I'd borrowed from Christy McDowell earlier that day. I didn't see the sense in telling Fletch yet that I wanted to do more than just hear the bells. At least not while we were still in my driveway and he could back out. Better to wait until we were down there, and the worst he could do was leave us without a ride home. We grabbed Carrie, and were properly on our way shortly after 8 o'clock. For the first hour or so, the drive was surprisingly pleasant. Carrie asked Fletch questions about where he was going to college, which schools were his safeties, and how he was going to pay for it. Fletch answered all of her questions, and was even joking around a bit, but as we got deeper into Massachusetts, his nerves started to creep in. He fell silent around the time we reached Worcester. It didn't take a mind reader to know that he was thinking about Rob. It was impossible not to. We were retracing the steps of a boy who had killed himself. Whatever he'd found down here, whether it was supernatural or not, whether it was something or nothing, Rob had blamed it for driving him to his madness and death. I'd never been scared of any of my other ghost hunting trips. Not really. Usually I was filled with a sense of anticipation, a giddy feeling that I could soon make a discovery that would forever change the way I saw the world, accompanied by a touch of anxiety that I might get caught trespassing somewhere I didn't belong. As we pushed into the trailer park, my heart was pounding in my chest and my palms were covered in a cold sweat. 10:30, Fletch said, cutting the engine. If we hustle, we might be able to hear the bells toll 11. Carrie and I nodded dumbly. I could tell that she was feeling it too. This was different than the Blood Cemetery or the Eunice Williams covered bridge. We were walking into the ghost story of Robert Edward Keenan. And the only thing we knew for certain was that he was dead. Pass me my bag, I said to Carrie as we stepped out of the car. Fletch wordlessly led the way. The crunch of the dead leaves beneath our feet echoed out into the forest, even though the moon cast more than enough light for us to see. I fished the flashlight out of my bag just to have something to do. It hadn't snowed yet that year, at least not at the Quabbin, but it was cold. The temperature had dropped into the high teens, and the wind ripping through the bare trees wasn't helping matters any. It was no surprise we didn't see anyone as we crossed into the park. We were in the middle of nowhere. Hell, if it weren't for those metal poles that served as a gate stretched across the old Ware Infield Road, we probably could have driven in without anyone noticing. The smell of wood smoke hung faintly in the air. Somewhere miles away, people were sitting around their fireplace, probably commenting on what a good night it was for a fire. I bet they felt cozy. Fletch rubbed his nose and sniffled. Could have just been the cold making his nose run a little, and maybe he smelled the smoke too. Either way, it reminded me of something I'd read once. Firemen say that when a person burns to death, their flesh smells like pork. I pitied Fletch. Thank God I hadn't been there to smell Rob burn. By the time we reached the fork where the access road splits off from Old Weir Enfield, my legs felt like blocks of ice. We had warm hats and jackets, but 2.5 mile walk at night in late December is too much for just a pair of jeans. I stomped my feet to warm up. What I wouldn't give for some ski pants. At least you brought gloves, Carrie said. She had one hand buried deep in her coat pocket, the other holding the flashlight I had given her with her sleeve pulled down over her fingers. Fletch cast a baleful eye in our direction. Even though he hadn't been particularly loud or said anything disrespectful, he looked at us as if he'd caught us dancing on Rob's grave. As far as Fletch was concerned, we were on hallowed ground. We pressed on in silence until, from just ahead of us, we heard whispering gently through the trees. Sounded vaguely like the Friday the 13th soundtrack was being carried in the wind across a great distance. What was that? Ice, I said. Ice makes noise? Yep. People think of ice as an object, solid and inert, but ice expands and contracts a great deal. Slight variations in temperature, small eddies and imperceptible currents prevent the water from freezing uniformly. Little fissures turn into big cracks, and the ice strains against itself until it buckles and splinters into plates. What we were hearing was like continental drift in miniature. Big ice plates pressing against each other until something snapped with the resulting sound echoing over the reservoir's frozen surface. We cleared the tree line, and sure enough, the Quabbin was frozen. I was surprised. Bodies of water as big as the Quabbin don't usually freeze until mid-January or so. Guess we won't be needing a raft, I thought. That's when the bells chimed 11. My body shuddered. I felt like I was beneath Alina, the weight pressing down on the parts of me that strained to meet her. My flesh tingled. It was as if the smooth skin of her back that my fingertips had danced lightly across now surrounded every inch of me. In that lingering moment, I was sated. The bells had nourished me like a feast nourishes the starving. I wanted nothing but to be exactly where I was, hearing exactly what I was hearing, feeling exactly what I was feeling. Then all was silence. I was once more out in the cold. I heard them, Carrie breathed. I turned to her and saw that she had a wistful gleam in her eyes. It was the first time, and the last time, that I ever truly saw her happy. Fletch fell to his knees, and tears rolled down his cheeks. Oh my God, he said. Oh my God. He was laboring to breathe. That was beautiful. I sat down beside him. The dirt beneath us was hard as a rock. The echo coming off the ice sounded like a gentle tide lapping on the shore. I looked up at the sky. So far away from the light pollution of Nashua, or Boston, or Lowell, I could see a myriad of stars I'd never noticed before. It's the sort of thing that makes someone feel small. But not me. I just peeked behind the reality's veil and discovered. I don't know what. Just that there was more. Not up there, around distant stars, suspended on the far side of an unfathomable great abyss, but right here. With nothing between us and this undiscovered country but a few hundred yards of ice and an hour's time. And the bells would toll 12. We should have left. We said we were only here to hear the bells. The only reason Fletch was even there was to make sure that we'd turn back. I'd witness what I'd been searching for throughout all of my ghost huntings.
I had evidence of the supernatural. Wasn't that all I ever wanted? One experience to bolster my faith, just one that I could point to, cling to, whenever I found myself besieged by doubt. I had certainly thought so. Until I heard those goddamn bells. I don't know which of us was the first to tentatively step onto the ice, but I recall clearly none of us voiced an objection, not even Fletch. The ice was slick, and we fell hard more than once, but we were all of us New Englanders, and no stranger to shuffling across an expanse of ice. The trick was to keep your weight centered above your feet. We talked in clipped bursts about what the bells had felt like to us, speaking in broken analogies, unable to fully share what the bells had awoken inside of us, but straining to convey it as best we could. I only felt it in a plane once. My parents even thought they couldn't really afford it. It took me to Disney. They were already fighting then. It was bad. But on the plane, going to Disney? When it started to take off... Carrie trailed off. The echo was louder than when we heard it from the shore. In my head, when I was 7, only rich people flew anywhere, and my parents were fighting. I felt lucky, you know? Fletch grunted his acknowledgement. What time is it? I checked my watch. About 15:15. Cuck. We must have been right on top where the ice was grinding against itself. We froze. Each of us strained our eyes and ears, trying to determine if the ice was safe. We knew if the ice wasn't safe, it'd be dangerous to press on. We knew it. But we didn't care. Maybe you should go first, Fletch said to me. You're the lightest. Yeah, I said, and shuffled ahead. Being closer to the bells felt worth the risk. Any risk. Carrie and Fletch followed in my wake, neither following directly behind me so as to spread our weight across a broader area. We pressed on. The conversation died. The wind blew hard across the reservoir and tore through our bodies like a knife. We didn't care. The sound was growing fainter. We had crossed nearly 3/4 of the distance of the island that had housed the spire. I never heard the ice crack, just the sharp inhalations of breath from a scream that never escaped her lips. Carrie plunged through the ice. I turned just in time to see her go under. Carrie came up thrashing, but as she hit the sides of the hole, she made more and more of the ice broke away, expanding the hole to the size of a kiddie pool. I shuffled my feet as fast as I could towards the edge. Fletch screamed for me to stop. No, it's not stable! Cold water sucks the heat from your body 32 times faster than air. Every second Carrie stayed in that water increased the likelihood her arms would go numb and she wouldn't be able to pull herself out of the water even if the ice stopped breaking. Lying on my stomach and spreading out as much of my weight across the surface as I could, I dragged myself out to the water's edge. Grab on! I held onto the shoulder strap and tossed my duffel bag into the water as close to Carrie as I could. Her hands fumbled, already rendered useless by the heat loss, but she managed to wrap her arms tight around the bulk of the bag. I pulled her up to the edge. She got most of her body out of the water before the ice cracked, and she fell back in, almost taking me with her. Strong hands grabbed my ankles and pulled me away from the hole. Fuck, fuck, fuck! Fletcher grunted as he struggled for traction on the ice. I don't know how he did it. But Fletch managed to get enough of a purchase that we were able to drag Carrie out of the water. Scary Carrie was white as a bone and panting from breath through chattering teeth. She struggled to get her hands to her knees. We've got to get her out of here, Fletch said. The pull of the bell had been broken. What the fuck were we thinking? Bring the car around, we'll meet you. The car was easily 2 miles away. Fletch nodded and was off, shuffling his feet across the ice as quickly as he could go. I was afraid to stand too close to carry out on the ice, but what choice did I have? She was still struggling just to crawl. I grabbed her by her ankles and dragged her across until we were far enough away from the hole that I felt comfortable enough to pull her to her feet.
still the ice went. As I watched Fletch slip out of sight behind the trees. It didn't sound gentle anymore. I put her arm over my shoulder. We shuffled along the best we could. Each time one of us slipped, I thought the ice had given away again. My heart would race, and I'd think, this is it. This is how I'm going to die. But instead, we just slammed down against the rock-hard surface. Gary followed my instructions. She didn't seem confused, but she wasn't talking either. By the time we'd reached the access road, her lips had turned pale blue, and the water in her hair had frozen. At the fork on Old Ware Enfield Road, I insisted that we trade jackets and give her my hat and gloves, one of which was wet from pulling her out of the water, but I figured it was better than nothing. Carrie fumbled and struggled to get out of her jacket. We had to stop walking so I could help her with her zipper. She fought me as I tried to get my hat over her enormous head, and in slurred speech complained she was hot. I knew what that meant. Carrie was in trouble. If I had a cell phone back then, I'd have bitten the bullet and called an ambulance. But I didn't get my first cell phone until 2001. I made Carrie run the rest of the way, even though she moved like a drunk in an old cartoon. Fletch saw us approaching the gate and, leaving the engine running, ran out to meet us. "How is she?" he asked, putting her arm over his shoulder. "We need to get her to a hospital." Fletch and I were moving as quick as we could while dragging Carrie along between us. "Do you know any around here?" "I don't know where the hospital is." "You don't know where the hospital is?" I screamed as we got into the car. "Why the fuck would I know where the nearest hospital is in Western Massachusetts?" Fletch put the car in drive and started heading towards Amherst, figuring there had to be a hospital there and we'd see signs for it on Route 9. If we had gone back the other way towards Nashua, we'd have been at a hospital in 11 minutes. Unfortunately, the way we chose, the nearest hospital was in Northampton, over an hour away. Even with the heat on full blast, the car was freezing, and practically, as soon as the doors closed, Carrie started stripping out of her clothes. "You've got to get back there with her," Fletch said. He was right. Before our week-long winter hike, our instructor chaperone taught us what to do in the event that somebody displayed any signs of hypothermia. You get them out of their wet clothes, you strip them down, and you get into a sleeping bag with them. It's called passive rewarming, and Carrie clearly needed it. I crawled over the emergency brake into the back seat with a half-naked, scary Carrie. She didn't fight me or complain about being warm, but it was difficult to get close to her. She had wedged herself down on the floor, mostly behind the passenger seat, a space I would have never imagined could accommodate me, let alone the both of us. "Hey, you got a blanket or anything?" I said, looking around the mess and clutter that Carrie sat on top of. No, but hang on." Fletch wrestled himself out of his jacket while he drove. It occurred to me that I could use the uninflated raft as a blanket, but when I looked for my duffel bag, I realized I must have dropped it somewhere between the reservoir and the car. Fletch threw his jacket back at me. It'd have to do. I stripped down to my underwear. Scary Carrie was completely unresponsive. I did my best to move her into a position where I could lay next to her and drape Fletch's jacket over my shoulders and mine over her legs before spreading myself over her belly. I'd like to say I spent the next hour concerned only for the well-being of my friend. But that's not true. A million thoughts ran through my mind. Yeah, I did think about Carrie. I thought she already looked dead. I hoped that at least some of her pale complexion was just the moonlight. I noticed how slow her breathing was. I could barely feel her cold gut moving at all. But I also thought about Rob and the rumors that I had repeated when I was in the sixth grade. The one about how he'd been found naked in the woods with a mentally handicapped girl. I thought about how everyone said that he tricked her into sleeping with him, and even as my friend lay beneath me, for all I knew dying, there was a small part of me that was thankful that we were far away from home and nobody would hear about this. Shortly before 1:30 in the morning, we pulled up in front of the emergency room at Cooley Dickinson's hospital. Fletch got out of the car and ran for help. Carrie was unconscious when a pair of nurses and orderlies, or whoever they were, pulled her out of the car and put her on a stretcher. When they asked me, I couldn't remember the last time I'd checked to see if she was still breathing. It had been at least a few minutes. At least. They couldn't find a pulse. Fletch and I were forced to stay in the waiting room. We couldn't do anything else for her. Carrie was in their hands now. In a way, that was worse.
At least for us, when we were in the car, we had a goal, something to focus on. We had to get Carrie to a hospital, and once we had arrived, the adrenaline had been coursing through our veins, and it returned to whence it came, and it left us with nothing but doubts. Could we have done more? Had we been fast enough? She'll be fine. She'll be fine. Fletch rocked back and forth in his chair, repeating his little mantra, as if he could will it to be. She'll be fine. She'll be fine. It was over an hour before we were able to get an update. Carrie had survived, but only just. When they initially started checking her vitals, Carrie's core temperature had fallen to 64 degrees Fahrenheit, and her heart rate slowed to 29 beats per minute. For a girl Carrie's age and size, you'd expect her resting heart rate to be in the neighborhood of 74 beats per minute. The emergency room doctor felt Carrie's hypothermia was too severe for external warming techniques and elicited to irrigate Carrie's stomach and colon with a warm saline solution. Every 15 minutes, the saline, by then cold, had to be pumped out and replaced with more warm saline. We had hoped that we'd be able to see her, but at that point, they'd only managed to raise her body temperature about 4 degrees, and Carrie, still unconscious. She also had third or fourth degree frostbite on several of her fingers and toes, and only one of her ankles. But they wouldn't have to worry about that tonight. There's a saying about frostbite. Frozen in January. Amputated by July. The nurse, a young, homely woman, looked at us like we were criminals. I guess she blamed us for the state Carrie was in. I'm not sure she was wrong. Is there someone your friend would want us to contact?
Her mom?
Yeah. I said, I'll do it. Payphone? Follow me. The nurse turned and led me back to the admittance desk. It's funny, as scared as I was that my friend's life was still in serious jeopardy, somehow I was also scared to be in trouble with her mom, and by extension, mine. What can I say? I lacked perspective, and the enormity of the situation hadn't fully sunk in. The lady let me use one of the hospital's phones. What? What do you want? Why are you calling my house at 3 fucking o'clock in the morning? Mrs. Peterson screamed into the phone. Carrie's been in an accident. What are you talking about? Carrie's asleep. Hold on. Carrie? Carrie? I could hear Mrs. Peterson lumbering through her house and bellowing for her daughter. She certainly had her faults, but lacking affection for her daughter wasn't one of them. I'd often suspected that Mrs. Peterson had been one of those sad sacks who had known their marriage wasn't going to last and insisted on having a kid anyway. Not to save the marriage, but just to have one person in the world that loved them unconditionally. What happened? Where is she? I told her that her daughter had fallen through some ice. Nothing else. And emphasized at every turn that she was alive and being cared for, which was true. But I also promised that she'd be fine. It was a promise I had no business making. I just couldn't stomach hearing the hurt in her voice. I would have said anything to make Mrs. Peterson feel better. I handed the phone back to the homely nurse so that she could give Mrs. Peterson directions to the hospital. 2.5 hours later, Ecto-1's tires screeched to a stop in the parking lot. My daughter, where is she? I could hear her even before she was through the doors. If the kids at school thought Carrie was frightening to behold, it was only because they'd never seen her mother upset. Mrs. Peterson ran up to the admittance desk, wearing her jacket over her bathrobe, the sweatpants she slept in peeking out over her snow boots. Her face was red and puffy from crying, her hair looked like, well, not just uncombed, but as if someone had tied it in knots and then dipped it in grease. By comparison, the homely nurse looked like Helen of Troy. She's my daughter! You have to let me see her! Mrs. Peterson said, pounding the desk in front of her. Being a mother was the reason Mrs. Peterson got out of bed in the morning. It was the reason she worked a thankless, poorly paying job, and it was the reason that she wasn't about to let anyone keep her from being there for her daughter. Fletch and I jogged the short distance down the hall from the waiting room. The hospital staff was looking nervously at Mrs. Peterson's red face and bulging veins. A pair of nurses moved in close behind the homely nurse to support her. You can't see her until she's been stabilized, the nurse said, her voice quivering. Mrs. Peterson let out an inarticulate scream that shook her whole body.
It was a desperate noise that sounded like a wounded animal. The homely nurse flinched. Fletch took an involuntary step back, and one of the other nurses peeled off from the pack and ran down the hall, probably to get security. She needn't have bothered. After her scream, Mrs. Peterson collapsed to the floor in tears. I laid my hand on her shoulder and I gave her a gentle shake. Mrs. Peterson looked up and saw that it was me. I thought for a moment I'd receive the same treatment as the nurses, but instead, she pulled me down on top of her and hugged me, clinging to me like I was life itself. Mrs. Peterson buried her face in my shoulder and cried. I wish she'd yelled at me, and not just because my face was pressed into her hair, which smelled of sweat, deli meat, and feta cheese. I'd nearly gotten her daughter killed. I didn't deserve to be embraced like a member of the family, and something about the way Mrs. Peterson so desperately held me reminded me of the trip her daughter and I had taken to Greenfield. I had been reckless with Carrie in so many ways. Fletch helped the two of us to our feet, and we led Mrs. Peterson back to the waiting room. We stopped at McDonald's on the way home, but neither of us could bring ourselves to eat anything. Fletch and I had stayed at the hospital until nearly 10 a.m. By that time, Carrie's temperature had returned to normal, but at no point had she regained consciousness. We'd have stayed longer, but we'd been awake for nearly 24 hours at that point, and our bodies were beginning to shut down. I left Mrs. Peterson my parents' number and told her to call me if she needed anything. She took it, and she thanked me for watching over her little girl. Sitting beneath the fluorescent lights, waiting for Fletch to finish his coffee, I felt like Judas, minus the silver. I should have stayed at the hospital, but I copped out. I couldn't stand Mrs. Peterson being nice to me. I never should have brought you. It was the first thing Fletch had said in hours. We'd have gone anyway, I said. Smearing ketchup around my tray with my hash brown so I wouldn't have to look him in the eyes. We'd have gone. She'd have fallen. And you wouldn't have been there to pull her out. I could have driven, or I could have tried to warm her, but I couldn't have done both. Fletch didn't respond. Guess he still felt like it was his fault. She'd be dead right now, Fletch. Me too, probably. I haphazard a gaze up and I wish I hadn't. He was giving me the same look that I had given Mrs. Peterson an hour earlier when she thanked me for watching over Carrie. Neither of us was ready to be forgiven yet. Well, he said, we should have left after we heard those fucking bells. I couldn't argue with him there. Fletch finished his coffee in silence. After he was done, neither of us moved to get up. It was probably around 10:30 or so at that point, and neither of us had called our parents. We knew we should have. Should have found the nearest payphone. We knew we couldn't hide what happened. Couldn't lie. At least not about Carrie. But even if it was only a couple of hours, we wanted to push that eventuality off for as long as possible. Our parents would know soon enough. We got back in the car and rolled down the windows, hoping the cold air would help keep Fletch awake long enough for the coffee to kick in. Fletch stopped for the light at the intersection at Amherst Road and Daniel Shea Highway. We needed to go left, which would take us north towards New Hampshire, but Fletch hadn't hit his blinker yet. Can I tell you something? Fletch had struggled to get out each word. Yeah. Part of me wants to go back. I want to hear them again. So did I. All we had to do was go right. Do you? If we did, do you think we could get there by 11? I asked. The light changed. We didn't move until the car behind us started honking. Fletch hit the blinker. We went left. My cheeks burned with shame. They probably wouldn't have made it in time, I said.
We can't go back there. Not ever.
No. Never. Even as I said it, I knew I would. The bells. The bells felt like home. My parents woke in the morning of December 28th, 1999, to a quiet house. Nothing unusual about that, they were typically the first ones up. My mother made coffee and my father turned on CNN and got on the treadmill. My brother woke up next. My mother made him French toast. She made some for me as well, figuring that I could reheat it whenever I came down. It was a couple of hours before my absence was felt. It's no big deal, they figured it was vacation. They might as well let me sleep in. Then around 11 o'clock, they got a call from Mr. Fletcher. He was in a bad mood.
Did Nathan stay over at your house last night?
No, I don't think so.
Well, if he did, wake his ass up and tell him he's in trouble.
My mom covered the receiver with her hand and hollered for my dad to go wake me up. That's when they found out I was missing. When Fletch and I showed up in the driveway 2 hours later, I'd say my parents were more annoyed than angry. My parents weren't strict disciplinarians. I'd slept over at Drew Lucas without consulting them on more than one occasion, and while they were never exactly thrilled with me, they trusted my judgment and preferred letting me exercise the judgment to being woken up by a late-night phone call looking for their permission. When they found my bed empty, they'd figured that we'd stayed up late playing video games, or, at worst, watching Skinemax movies over at some friend's or another's, and were just too tired to drive home. Fletch's parents weren't so understanding. They called everyone Fletch was friends with. They called my parents looking for the names of my friends.
Nathan, you'd better get your butt home, my dad said. Then he held his thumb and forefinger up about an inch apart and added, Your dad sounds like he's about this close to going through the phone book in alphabetical order looking for you.
He was trying to be funny. But Fletch and I weren't in much of a mood to laugh. We exchanged one last tired look, but knowing things were going to get worse before they got any better, we parted ways. I stood on the front steps of my house with my father watching Fletch drive off down the road.
Boy, am I glad I'm not him right now, my dad said. He didn't know the half of it.
Dad, we... I have to tell you something. They didn't yell. And they didn't scream. But the days of my parents trusting my judgment were over. I had stayed out all night without permission, driven deep into another state, and gone out onto unfamiliar, recently frozen ice in the middle of the night. That was stupid. That was so stupid. My father got up from the table and headed for the phone. He'd never been good at sitting still when he was agitated.
Why were you even in Amherst? My mother asked.
We wanted to visit Sam, I mumbled. I'd never been a particularly good liar, but Fletch and I had agreed to leave Rob's suicide note and the spire in the woods out of our story. Fletch was convinced that if his dad caught even the faintest whiff that his son believed in ghost stories, he'd be stuck on meds as fast as the nearest psychologist would write the prescription. My mom stared straight at me and couldn't hold her gaze and pretended to be interested in the French toast that she'd reheated for me.
That could have been you. Do you understand? That could have been you that fell through the ice, and with no one else around...
My mom was too choked up to finish her thought. I wanted to comfort her, but I didn't want her to look at me.
Yes, you have a patient there named Carrie...
My dad sucked the phone under his chin and asked, What's Carrie's last name? While my dad was concerned for Carrie, he was also motivated by self-interest. I could hear in his voice that he had spent the first 10 years of his career working in litigation at the law firm of Ropes and Gray and believed the importance of CYA, covering your ass. It didn't matter how slim the chances were that Mrs. Peterson would attempt to hold our family or the Fletchers accountable for what happened to her daughter. That risk was unacceptable. If you need any help, he said, once he'd gotten Mrs. Peterson on the phone,
you know,
around the house, driving Carrie to school. He was feeling around, trying to get a sense of whether or not Mrs. Peterson blamed us for what happened to her daughter. Maybe dealing with the insurance company, or hell, I don't know. If you need help with the medical bills, whatever you need, just say the word. He also wanted to dangle that carrot. He knew Mrs. Peterson wouldn't be able to cover Carrie's emergency medical care out of pocket, and he doubted slicing meat at the deli counter in the market basket conferred with it amazing health insurance. Mrs. Peterson would need help. But it would come with strings attached. Looking back at my father's actions, they seemed cold. And maybe they were. But isn't protecting your kids what good fathers do? Don't they protect their children even when their children don't particularly want to be protected? Had Mrs. Peterson had a vengeful bone in her body, I'd have deserved the brunt of everything she could muster. Despite my exhaustion, I had trouble falling asleep. I kept thinking about Carrie. She was in the hospital, and it was my fault. I hadn't talked her into anything, but I had involved her. I brought her along, and now she was the one lying in a hospital bed with her mother crying over her. As a Catholic, you're taught that God created us as rational beings. You're taught that he gave us the dignity to initiate and control our own actions. He imbued us with the ability to hold our own counsel so that we may be able to choose our own paths. And that we alone are responsible for the fruit that our choices bear. I don't believe that everything's part of a plan. And the people who saw God's hand in every mundane earthly event, from athletes who credit Jesus for their ability to hit a curveball, to teenagers invoking the name of the Lord to secure a date on Saturday night, drove me crazy. I'd never accepted predestination. How could we have free will if, like clockwork, everything was preordained to happen? I believed these things. I did, but lying there, thinking of the Petersons, I couldn't stop myself from wondering if God was teaching me a lesson. I've been taught that God doesn't cause car accidents or tornadoes. But in that moment, I felt that God had broken the ice beneath Carrie's feet to punish me for both doubting his existence and having stolen a glimpse of the secret knowledge no one but God was meant to have. I cried, and I whispered Hail Marys and Our Fathers to myself until I was finally overtaken by exhaustion. Dim light filtered in through my blinds. The windows in my room faced south in my semi-conscious state. I wasn't sure if the sun was rising or setting. My stomach growled, but I couldn't bring myself to get out of bed and face my parents. The bells tolled. I sat bolt upright in my bed. The room was still and silent, and yet I could hear the bells as they continued to call out the hour. 2, 3, they were beautiful. I didn't lose myself to them as I had on the shore of Quabbin. 4. They sounded like a song stuck in your head. 5. They stopped. I was lying in bed. Either I had never sat up, or I had lain back down without realizing it. Had I heard them, or had I remembered them? At the reservoir, we'd heard them toll 11. Had it just been a dream? I sat up for what may have been the second time, and I looked at my clock. It was 5. In the past 2 days, I'd only slept for 3 hours. I couldn't handle being in the dark. I went downstairs. I spent the rest of the night studiously avoiding eye contact with my family. Thankfully, I didn't hear the bells again that night. The next morning, bright and early, my father drove me over to Carrie's house. My parents had put together a care package for Mrs. Peterson, a large basket filled with food so that she wouldn't have to cook, gift cards from our local gas station to offset the back and forth to the hospital each day, and a few books to read in the waiting room. When she opened the door, Mrs. Peterson was so grateful she cried. When she regained her composure, the two of us got into Ecto-1 and we headed over to the 2.5 drive to Cooley Dickinson Hospital. My dad had volunteered me to go and keep Mrs. Peterson company. Now, he may have had ulterior motives, but this was something that I wanted to do. Something I had to do. The drive was awkward.
Under the best of circumstances, as a teenager, spending time alone with one of your friends' parents is always a little uncomfortable, and these were far from the best circumstances. As I learned on the drive, Carrie was in a coma. Although Mrs. Peterson got virtually none of the medical terms correct, her only real exposure to medicine came from watching a lot of ER, I managed to get the gist of what she was saying. As Carrie's heart rate slowed, so had her breathing. Her blood had failed to supply her brain with oxygen that it needed, and it was the lack of oxygen that probably contributed more to Carrie's blue coloration than her body temperature. The doctors had given Mrs. Peterson only one tiny piece of good news. Because hypothermia lowers a body's metabolism, it reduced the likelihood that the oxygen deprivation had damaged Carrie's brain. That was what we were pinning all of our hope on. That the cold, which nearly killed her, had also slowed her brain down enough that it hadn't noticed that it was suffocating. When we arrived at the hospital, Carrie's mom led me to her new room. I could tell from the look of the staff. I could tell from the look the staff was giving her along the way that Mrs. Peterson was not their favorite person. Maybe she'd been a pain in the ass the day before, but I didn't feel like that was it. Not exactly. The nurses were giving Mrs. Peterson the same looks the kids at school gave her daughter. In movies and television, people frequently comment on how peaceful coma patients appear. They say it's like they're asleep. They look like an angel, or it reminds me of when they were a baby and I used to hold them. I don't know if that was what Mrs. Peterson's impression was, but it certainly wasn't mine. Ordinarily, Carrie wore a lot of concealer to cover up her acne. At some point between plunging beneath the ice and having saline pumped in and out of her stomach, most of it had disappeared. She had a tube running into her nose, I'm not sure why, a heart rate monitor on her finger and an IV in her arm, and that was to say nothing of the frostbite. Along with the big toe on her right foot and most of her left foot below the ankle, which we couldn't see beneath a blanket, ice crystals had formed in two fingers on her left hand and the thumb of her right. The blood trapped in her fingers swelled them to almost the thickness as her wrist. They were red and raw. It was difficult not to stare at them. Mrs. Peterson believed that even in a coma, Carrie could hear us, and proceeded to relive seemingly everyday moments of her daughter's life. Mrs. Peterson was not a gifted storyteller. In her mind, nothing was too trivial. From the time that she caught Carrie washing the dishes with cold water, which is apparently something you shouldn't do, to the time they went to Applebee's for her birthday and both forgot to tell the server, then wondered why they didn't get any cake. But what her stories lacked in content, Mrs. Peterson made up for in sentiment. She couldn't touch Carrie's hands, so she held her daughter's upper arm as she spoke. I'm sorry I'm not home more. I like to be. I would. I know how hard school's been for you. Maybe it'd been easier if I was home more. I don't know. You've done so good, baby, and college is right there. If Carrie was able to hear her mother, it wasn't outwardly apparent. Her face didn't twitch, her eyelids didn't flutter. Even her pulse on the heart rate monitor held steady. I remember in middle school, You never thought. As Mrs. Peterson began to break down, she grabbed my wrist and pulled me to her daughter's bedside, forcing my hands to replace her own on Carrie's arm. Never thought you'd get a boy like you, but look who's here. I didn't know if Carrie had told her mother that we were dating or if Mrs. Peterson had just gotten the wrong idea about us, but either way, I couldn't correct her, not there. I had enough trouble rejecting Carrie when we were alone in Greenfield. The thought of rejecting her again, this time in front of her mother and stealing Mrs. Peterson, whatever sense of pride that she derived from her daughter having a romantic life was, well, it was more than I could bear. There's a special place in hell for people who humiliate children in front of their parents. I was very aware of my hands resting on her arm. She was so much warmer than the last time I touched her. I've never been quick on my feet. I have no idea what to say, especially with Mrs. Peterson thinking I was Carrie's... what? Boyfriend? I took a page out of Mrs. Peterson's playbook and I stood over my unconscious friend, recounting meeting her on the hike
and a few anecdotes from class, I tried to muster up something more sentimental, but it wasn't until I pretended it was Elena lying there in front of me that any words came. I can't stop thinking about you. I wish we could talk. I'd do anything to make you better. Lost in the little scene that I had created for myself, I leaned down and I kissed Carrie's waxy forehead. Mrs. Peterson put her arm around me and squeezed. I looked at the tears in her eyes and I wondered if I had done her a kindness by playing along. The lie seemed harmless enough. Carrie probably just wanted to save face with her mom, maybe make her proud, let her think her child was happy for a change, but eventually the truth would come out. I wasn't attracted to Carrie. It'd be nice if I was, but I wasn't. I also resented being blindsided. If Carrie asked my permission, had said, "Look, this is embarrassing, especially after Greenfield, but I need your help making my mom happy. Is it okay if I tell her you're my boyfriend?" I might have said yes, but she hadn't. The whole charade made me feel gross. Elena's family returned from Swanee the following morning. I would have liked to have been outside their house waiting for her when they arrived, but I was still a month away from getting my driver's license, and my parents weren't exactly in the mood to help advance my social life. I left a message on the Amenev machine in the morning around 10 o'clock. I called again at noon and 1, but hung up both times before the machine began recording. It was a strange poker game you play when you're in love for the first time. You feel like you'll die if you don't speak to the object of your affection as soon as possible. But you know how crazy you'd seem if you filled up their answering machine with increasingly redundant messages. That afternoon felt like an eternity. She called me back shortly after 5, and even though I was already sitting directly in front of the phone, I let it ring twice so she wouldn't know I'd been sitting directly next to the phone. "I missed you," I said. "Oh, thanks." She sounded tired. Maybe she hadn't gotten that much sleep before driving home, or maybe she was drained from therapy. Either way, that wasn't the reaction I was hoping for. I wasn't sure what I wanted to tell her about my trip to the Quabon, or rather, I wasn't sure how to tell her. The whole idea of going was to alleviate her guilt. Having heard the bells, I know that the story was at least partially true. There was more to the spire in the woods than the side effects of an antidepressant. But I also knew that Elena wouldn't take the news of Carrie very well. For that matter, I wasn't taking it all that great either. How was Maine?
Too short. Trying to convince my parents to drive us back up. If not tonight, then tomorrow. But my dad's sick of driving.
I wanted to tell her everything, but it had to be face to face. If she took it hard, I couldn't comfort her from halfway across town. Not properly. There was a long silence as I weighed my options. When she broke the silence, her voice sounded small and young and distant.
Did you find the widower's clock?
Do you think that you could come over today after my parents go to sleep? There was another silence, though not as long as the last one.
Why?
It's not really the sort of thing that you tell someone over the phone. I stood by my window looking out of the front lawn. Its yellow grass illuminated by a couple of our tackier Christmas decorations. The wind shook the dead branches of the trees that grew next to the driveway. Something about the scene reminded me of the Quabon and the sound the ice makes when it's quiet. It was nearly midnight, and I wondered if Carrie would dream of those bells. Being in a coma might not be so bad if they sounded as lovely in sleep as they did in real life. There have been times in my past when I've been lonely. Consider the virtue of trading the world for a lifetime of dreams. Today I'd make that trade in a heartbeat. It meant never hearing the bells again. Headlights flashed into my windows, interrupting my thoughts as Elena pulled her little beetle into my driveway. I crept downstairs to meet her. Despite everything that had happened in the last couple of days, I couldn't help but feel excited. She was shivering when I opened the door and didn't appear to have showered that day, but she looked so beautiful. framed as she was by the Christmas lights surrounding our door, and with the porch light behind her head casting a glow around her. It was like she was separated from everything dark and dead outside. I hugged her. She hadn't worn a jacket, just the sweats that she probably slept in during the winter. She stood stiffly, and I rubbed her back and arms in an effort to warm her up. I figured she was nervous about what I'd tell her, but was still disappointed that she hadn't greeted me more enthusiastically. I led her into the kitchen and set about making us a couple of mugs of instant hot chocolate. Alina leaned against the island behind me, but that didn't last for very long. Before I'd even gotten the mug in the microwave, she was pacing and chewing nervously at her lower lip. "So, what happened?" I handed her her mug. "Do you want to sit?"
"No, no, I sat enough today."
I brought her into the den, which was further away from my parents' room. The embers in my father's wood stove still glowed brightly, and I added a couple of small pieces of kindling.
"Please, please tell me what you found,"
I told her. I told her everything, how cold it was, what Carrie and Fletch had been like, what the smell of the smoke reminded me of. I told her about the sound of the ice made. I told her about the bells. They were heavenly, but it wasn't just the sound. They fed something inside of me. You know, that part of you, that voice in your head that kind of experiences what happens and sees through your eyes. She looked at me as I spoke, and I could almost see the part of her I was talking about behind her eyes. "Like the soul or whatever," I continued. "It was like the bells enveloped it and gave it everything it ever wanted, everything it was missing." "For me, it was you." It was a bit embarrassing, describing to her how the bells had reminded me what it felt like to lie beneath her. But how else could I have conveyed the contentment in their presence and the need in their absence? The bliss and the longing. It was romantic, too, I thought. It could be more flattering for Alina to hear that my admission, that my purest desire was to lie close to her, to feel her body against mine. That it quieted my soul. But she didn't react as though she was flattered. Alina stared straight into the stove at the flames consuming the wood and said nothing. It took me a moment to realize that she was probably thinking. She was also what Rob heard in the bells. What quieted his soul. She was his bliss and longing. Even if she never wanted to be. We sat in silence for a long time, watched the wood burn, and then I told her about how we had pressed on, about what happened to Carrie. Would blame herself for Carrie falling through the ice, just like she had blamed herself for Rob's suicide. It was a sort of negative feedback loop a person gets into when they're depressed. Everything's their fault. What I hadn't considered was how much I'd blamed myself. Beyond answering a few of my parents' questions about how Mrs. Peterson was doing, I hadn't told anyone about my return trip to the hospital. For that matter, I hadn't really told anyone how I felt seeing Carrie turning blue, or struggling to warm her up on the floor of Fletch's car. Telling Alina about it opened up the floodgates inside of me. Alina let me speak until I couldn't get any more words out. Then she slid along the couch to my side, wrapped me in her arms, and held me like a child. For a moment, I felt ashamed. I'd never judged other guys for crying. I had sat beside Fletch when he was overcome by grief. But this was different. Carrie hadn't died. And I was with Alina, who I wanted more than anything to think of me as a man. I felt so small. She ran her hand up and down my back, little by little. I became more aware of her and her closest to me than I was of my emotions. My face was cradled against her neck. My cheek brushed hers as I moved to look up at her. Her eyes looked as though she'd been crying too. I kissed her, and it was like the first time, with her lips slow to respond. Slowly, we inched our way back onto the couch until I was lying on top of her. It felt like the bells. My hand traced its way down her arms and over her shirt. My pulse beat faster than it had ever before. I was acutely aware of my body, how it felt, where it was in relation to Aelina's, but I lost all conscious thought, aware of nothing but touch and pulse. I slid my hand beneath her clothes. She didn't stop me. Her sweatpants came down easily. She trembled. She was nervous. So was I. My hand shook as I took my own pants down. I'd never exposed myself to anyone. Her face was inscrutable. I don't feel right describing the details of her body. We were kids then. I'm an adult now. I don't know what I was doing then. I know now. It was my first time. I don't know if it was hers. We don't exactly talk these days. It was short and fumbling and awkward, but I thought at the time that it was divine. Afterwards, I didn't want her to leave, but she got dressed anyway. She was shaking as she pulled up her pants and crying by the time she reached the door. I thought maybe she was scared because maybe we hadn't used a condom or that she was having survivor's guilt, but I was wrong. She was reluctant to let me hug her. "It's okay," I said. We didn't do anything wrong. She said, "Yeah," and ran her hand back through her wild hair. Not to get it out of her face, but like, you would if you didn't know the answer on a test. After she left, I stood at the window for a long time, staring out into the night, at the place where her tailgate lights had disappeared. I didn't sleep easily that night. I felt like I should have been more excited than I was. A lifetime of coming-of-age movies and pop culture had led me to believe that I'd feel something different about myself and the world. But I didn't. The view from my bed looked exactly as it had the night before. Carrie was still in the hospital, and far from restoring Aelina to her former self, consummating our relationship had left her as unhappy as ever. I tried to imagine a future with Aelina. One where I made her happy, and she made me, but I only wound up thinking about the bells. Maybe she needed to hear them. I fell asleep shortly before 3 a.m, which, unbeknownst to me, was almost exactly where Carrie woke up screaming. I'd love to tell you what Carrie's first words were. Unfortunately, I can't. When her heart had slowed down, an area of her brain located beneath the left temple hadn't received enough oxygen. Essentially, she'd had a stroke which left her with a condition called expressive aphasia. She could make sounds, that was not a problem, and with effort she could say words, but she couldn't form sentences. Of course, Mrs. Peterson and I didn't know that when she picked me up the morning of New Year's Eve. All we knew was that Carrie was awake. Mrs. Peterson shook with laughter as we drove down 495. She was going so fast I thought Ecto-1 was going to disintegrate, like one of those experimental jet planes that you see in old stock footage. Carrie's mom beamed with pride, clapped her hand up and down on my knee, and said, "Boy, I tell you, you got yourself one tough girl." I smiled back at her. I honestly did, thinking Carrie was essentially out of the woods. I was thrilled, but I didn't know what else to say, or maybe I was too busy worrying that now that she was awake, Carrie might not be quick enough on the uptake to figure out what was going on, and her mom would realize our relationship was a lie. I wouldn't have worried had I realized how severe Carrie's aphasia was. Mrs. Peterson was humming arithmetically as we pulled into the parking lot. She walked into the hospital with a spring in her step. She looked at the nurses like they were old friends or comrades in arms, as if to say, "We've been through some rough times together, but now that's all behind us and I couldn't have made it without you." She couldn't be bothered to stop and speak to any of them. The look on Mrs. Peterson's eyes and the spring in her step lasted until we reached Carrie's door. "Mom. Boy. Dad. Arm. Wrist. Bat. Wrist. Wrist. Mom. Medicine." Her speech was labored. I could see her struggling with each syllable. Mrs. Peterson told me to go get the doctor, and in that simple sentence, I could literally hear the happiness drain from inside of her. The woman who had practically skipped down the hospital's corridors deflated as she took her place by her daughter's side.
I think what I feel the worst about, at least in regards to Carrie, I saw in that moment. In most regards, Mrs. Peterson wasn't much of a person. She wasn't smart. She didn't have much of a sense of humor. She'd never been a great conversationalist or within a stone's throw of attractive. She was dirt poor, and her personal hygiene left a lot to be desired. In many ways, she was a social definition of a failure, but there, in an air of grace, in the resigned way she stepped to her daughter's side, yeah, what little light she had in her life seemed dimmer. All the hope she's ever had for her daughter had been snuffed out. But she wasn't going anywhere. She was going to shoulder the load and give her daughter everything she could. I tell myself that accident or no, Carrie and I would have drifted apart anyway during college. After all, even if her aphasia had fully dissipated, there's no way we could have gone to the same school. But the truth is that after that morning, I never could stand to be in the same room as Carrie. Every time she stammered or shifted her weight on her crutches, it filled me with self-loathing and I couldn't take it. I went to the nurse's station. They told me that they'd call in the doctor with a background in neurology, and a half hour later, Dr. Walsh stepped into Carrie's room. I don't remember much about him other than that he had silver hair, and his bedside manner could be charitably described as detached. Hospital man, doctor, arm, bat, nurse. She wants another painkiller, he said. She's probably going to lose that hand. Mrs. Peterson asked Dr. Walsh why her daughter couldn't speak properly, and he explained to us what they expected to find once they gave Carrie a CT scan. See, people always talk about how we don't use more than 2 or 10 or 12% of our brains, but that's a load of crap. We use all of it because every part of the brain has certain tasks and functions associated with it. Even a small injury can cause very serious and pronounced effects, like Carrie's expressive aphasia. It didn't affect any other aspect of her cognition. She probably even knew what she wanted to say, but she just couldn't get the words out. Now, luckily, Dr. Walsh said, the brain is fairly elastic, so given time, some of the undamaged areas surrounding the affected region could compensate and she could regain her normal speech. Aphasia isn't uncommon in stroke victims. We often see a full recovery within a year. Conversation with Dr. Walsh, Carrie would attempt to interject. If it seemed like she needed something or was asking a question, we would try to figure out what she was saying. Otherwise, Mrs. Peterson would just stroke her daughter's hair until she settled back down. Mostly Carrie seemed concerned with pain from her frostbite, but just as Dr. Walsh was excusing himself, she said something, shouted it really, that made her hair stand on end.
Hear sounds. Ring, 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 ring.
She fell silent. Mrs. Peterson looked up at Dr. Walsh.
What does she want?
Dr. Walsh took out a small flashlight and shined it into Carrie's eyes. Her pupils were unresponsive. She may also have damage to her auditory cortex. We'll know more once we get her scanned. I glanced down at my watch. It had just turned 10.